The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening. Thank you, Chris. You and Independent Blue Cross have been the wind beneath our wings. You have underwritten this amazing success story and made it possible. We thank you on behalf of the Free Library, the City of Philadelphia, and everyone whose life has been enriched by this program. Thank you. In just a few minutes, you will hear from our panel, Dave Eggers, Valentino Achak-Dang, and Mary Williams, as they talk about this year's featured selection, What is the What? This stunningly powerful novel, written so that Valentino could tell the world the whole truth of his existence, has been the focus of 2 intense months of reading, discussions, and programs throughout Philadelphia and beyond. The story of Valentino's painful odyssey from Mareil Bai across the deserts and wetlands of Northeast Africa, his experiences in refugee camps and as an immigrant in Atlanta, has touched us to the core, bringing home to us the horrific impact of the ongoing Sudanese civil war, including genocide, on the lives of millions of innocents, especially the children. Many of us have been moved to respond to Valentino's wish, since you and I exist, together we can make a difference. This was a banner season for one book. We reached more people, created more programs, engaged more community partners, produced more advertising, had more media exposure, and attracted record-breaking attendance at our opening and closing events. That's amazing, and it would not have happened without the devoted, tireless efforts of our volunteers, library staff, community partners, and generous sponsors. I thank you all from the bottom of my heart. I particularly want to recognize Jerry Truskin, our phenomenal program manager, who runs this complex, multifaceted program so brilliantly. Thank you, Jerry, wherever you are. For me, the most significant fact about one book is how it has transformed the life of our region via the shared experience of reading and discussing one book and attending programs about that book. People from diverse backgrounds who ordinarily would not interact, exchange views and personal stories, gain understanding of each other's lives, and come to the realization that whatever our differences may be, we share a common humanity, belong to the same human family. This year, our known family grew to include members of the local Sudanese and Darfurian community, some of them being so-called lost boys and girls with stories similar to Valentino's. Their accounts were published weekly in City Paper, thanks to the students of the Drexel Writing Program. A local high school student was so deeply moved by the story of one Sudanese young man separated from his mother since he was a little boy that he has started a fund to help finance a reunion trip to Australia, where she now resides. That's what you call making a difference. One Book, One Philadelphia was founded by the Free Library of Philadelphia in partnership with the Office of the Mayor of Philadelphia. This is the first year that our dynamic new mayor has participated in the program, and we are extremely grateful for his enthusiastic support and encouragement, including his presence here tonight. I am now privileged and delighted to introduce my new one-book partner, the Honorable Michael Nutt.
Marie, thank you very, very much. And it really is a pleasure to be here. And I just want to let you know that there really is going to be a program tonight. And if you can just hang in there with us somewhere in the course of the next 2 hours after the rest of us talk, we're actually going to put a program on. I have to say a couple things about Marie, and then I'm actually going to be the person to move things along. For 5 years now, you have been the passionate advocate for this wonderful event, and all of us owe you the greatest gratitude for your efforts and your support and your commitment. And ladies and gentlemen, let us please recognize you. A couple of our other big co-sponsors, and you know, of course, even with all of Marie's heart and soul and energy that goes into this, you need a few other folks to help you out. And so let me recognize and first thank Chris Cashman and, of course, Joe Frick from IBC, our own Independence Blue Cross. Chris? The library itself, an incredible board, both for the library and for the foundation. Linda Johnson and Joe McPeak. Two great individuals, Bill Sasso and Mayor Good. And of course, you know, in addition to one book, One Philadelphia, there is excitement in the air with regard to our own central branch of the Free Library, the most dynamic and exciting expansion project. Which all of us are getting behind. This will be one of the most beautiful libraries, but beyond that, one of the most beautiful buildings anywhere, not just in Philadelphia, but anywhere in the United States. And so let us collectively express our support. Now, we know, of course, that the mission of One Book, One Philadelphia is to promote literacy and the development of a community spirit. And what better place, of course, than to have this kind of program at our own free library, which every day provides the liberating experience of people getting knowledge and information, literacy services, which we're in a discussion now about expanding citywide. I look forward to continuing this partnership, not only out of the mayor's office, but across the entire city government, working with the library, working with One Book, One Philadelphia, and, of course, my new partner, Marie Field, in our efforts here. And so with that, lastly, as you know, that One Book, One Philadelphia has now spawned a partner or a new entity called One Film, One Philadelphia, which had its debut earlier this year. I participated in that as well. I have the great pleasure, this is the part where you say, finally. I have the great pleasure of introducing this evening's panelists. One note. It was mentioned earlier, and I think Chris may not have known this. Dave Heller, who was going to be leading the discussion here this evening from WHYY, has taken ill. And so Dave Eggers actually will perform double duty. But let us now have our panelists, Dave Eggers, Valentina Oshak Dang, and Mary Williams, to lead the discussion here tonight.
Thank you. Yeah.
Is it work where it is right now? All right. Move a little. How's that? Better? All right. Good. You can keep telling me if it's not right. It's great to be here. Wow. It's an exciting time in Philadelphia in general, huh? We've just been all hearing about everything going on here, and feel it's very exciting to be in your city this week. So, and it's exciting to be with Mary and Valentino. We were trying to figure out when we were all together last, because usually it's over the phone or individually meeting, and we figured out that the last time was at my wedding.
Right.
The last time I saw you guys, you were both on the dance floor. I have this very clear vision of it. So we want to thank the organizers of One Book, One Philadelphia for bringing us back together after some years. So I was scrambling today to put together some sort of program for today as moderator, and I hope I will do a good job. And we're just going to try to chat loosely about sort of how all this came about and what's happened since. Does that sound like okay? Hi. All right. Bear with me. Be merciful. So I wanted to start with, well, let's start. Now, Mary, you started the Lost Boys Foundation in Atlanta before Valentino got to the U.S. And can you tell us a sort of about why did you form this group, and what was the impetus and the challenges of starting up the group?
Well, my background is in international health, and I had done some development work abroad. And when I decided to come back to America, I wanted to continue working with refugees. And so I was working with an organization called the International Rescue Committee. And I got this article from the New York Times about a group of refugees called the Lost Boys, because they were going to be coming to Atlanta, and they were going to be coming through my office. At the time, I was the person who would be responsible for getting them adjusted to life in the United States and helping them find jobs and acclimating them, basically. So I'm reading the story. Everybody knows the story, right? So I'm reading the story, and my eyes are getting bigger and bigger, and I'm thinking, oh, my God, they're going to come in here. They're going to be these traumatized group of people and anger and, you know, separation issues. They didn't have their parents and just all the horror that they'd gone through. So I'm sitting there waiting. And then the day that they arrive, I'm in my office, and like seven of the young men come in my office, and they're all smiling, and they're bright-eyed, and they're speaking fluent English, you know. And I'm like, you know, it was amazing. And the first thing they asked was, you know, when am I going to go to school, and where's the job that I'm going to have? And they were so motivated, and it inspired me. A couple of months later, I quit that job, and I started the Lost Boys Foundation to help them, because they only get 3 months of assistance, and then they're kind of on their own. And I wanted to give them a better shot at making it in America, and that's when I started the foundation.
What were the major challenges that the guys were facing when they got to Atlanta? There was 3 months of sort of money for food and rent, and then, you know, there were health problems too, and like, and all the things that we take for granted, insurance and sort of even GEDs that you had to work with some of the guys on?
The major educational problem is that a lot of them were over the age of 21, and so you can't have a 22-year-old sitting in a high school. So they couldn't go the route of traditional high schools. There was some educational gaps. I mean, they knew a lot, but there were some educational gaps that didn't quite get them through the GED, so there would be a lot of tutoring that was necessary. So we got a lot of volunteers. There was health issues. As you can imagine, there was also some young men I felt were suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder issues. So there were lots of challenges that they had, and I just did the best I could in terms of bringing in volunteer physicians and volunteers who were willing to just take them into their homes, and all different kinds of volunteers with different specialties to make the transition better.
Well, you did everything from moving guys into apartments, demonstrating how everything worked, all the appliances and everything, driving lessons, everything, right?
Oh, yeah, driving, introduction to running water, the drama of going into a supermarket and seeing the vast array of food that's available and trying to choose and not knowing what it is in that box or what it's for. And it was extraordinary. I think Dominique can speak a little bit about
it. You saw all of it.
Yeah.
Now, you knew that you were going to slip and call Valentino dominant. Do you want to explain? Valentino, why Mary?
He's going to say why I'm calling him Dominic instead of Valentino. It's not because I don't love him and know his real name.
I came using my nicknames. Dominic is a name that came through another story.
If it's in the book, you know, to get the attention of that
we
one
used
teacher,
to have,
Miss Gladys,
We used to have Miss Gladys, who was our drama director in my high school, and she had this one Dominic among us as the name that she remembers a lot, because we all look alike. And also everyone among the group members want Miss Gladys to know him. So whenever she calls you Dominic, you don't say no. That's the name that's going to bring you closer to her. And the whole group became, you know, Nick was nicknamed as Dominic.
You know, still, we still run into Dominics, you know, they say, oh, I'm one of the Dominics. All over the country now.
Are you meeting many of them on your trips?
Yeah, I have 3 or 4 Dominics.
Excellent.
So, Valentino, you want to talk about when you first got on a plane. You had spent 10 years at Kakuma, and you had a few days of preparation, sort of orientation in Kakuma, where they go through the most rudimentary aspects of, you know, adjustment to life in the U.S. And what were your expectations for those first few days, and did you know, you know, did you think that you were going to be have a lot of help when you got here from agencies, and sort of what was that adjustment like, and maybe lead into when you met Mary and the Lost Boys Foundation?
Well, first of all, you know, when I was awarded the prize to come to the U.S., it happened that my original flight was on September 11, 2001. I was stranded in Nairobi for 2.5 weeks, and I knew at that point that I was coming into the United States that was already in trouble, and people would not be looking for immigrants. You know, people were concerned about security matters. Mary had a few cases of young men who couldn't go out from their apartment in Atlanta at that time. And so I knew that I was coming to face new challenges as opposed to what many other immigrant groups faces. And I came to New York and I was worried. I thought that I would be sent back. But in New York I was told that my route had been changed, that I was going to a new place. And my caseworker would not say what this new place is. And I began to worry about being sent to to Fargo. Because I did not want to go to where it snows so badly.
When you were originally scheduled to go to San Jose.
Yeah, I was scheduled to go to San Jose, and I knew that there were good temperatures there, and I could cope with that. But being sent to Fargo was my immediate concern. Well, that evening, I was told that I was being sent to Atlanta. And the first time I heard about Atlanta was in 1996, when the Olympic Games were played there, and the Nigerian Super Eagle Soccer Club won the Olympic Championship. It was celebrated all over Africa, and I heard about Atlanta at that time. But I was sent to Atlanta, and my immediate challenge was the fact that I had to begin living in an apartment and paying my own rent. And I didn't have a job, so I needed a job immediately. At that time, even many people were laid off because of September 11, and businesses were affected. But luckily enough, the IRC, you know, had a plan of helping newly arriving refugees to find jobs and also to attend English classes. I was sent to the class, and my teacher, you know, released me on the same note. He told me that I didn't need the ESL training, that I can just look for a job or take my time to rest. So my immediate challenge was how to know to get a good job and how to pay my own rent. Meanwhile, I prepare to go to school.
And Mary, how long were you in the country, Valentino, before you went into the Lost Boys offices? And maybe you can talk about first meeting Valentino and sort of when he became kind of the spokesman for all the guys in Atlanta.
I remember I came on Wednesday, and then on Mary used to have meeting on Saturdays with the guys in Atlanta, and on Saturdays is when the volunteers would come, people who want to help. And Mary had set up Saturdays as days for meetings, for brainstorming, and for, assigning people with their volunteers. And the guys told me that, Valentino, you are here. You used to do public speaking in Kakuma. We're going to take you to Mary Williams. I think she's going to love working with you. That was some of the guys who knew me. And on Saturday, we went. And I was taken back to where Mary worked. And I was introduced to Mary by Momo, my roommate. And I could tell at that immediately that I wanted to work with Mary. And Mary said, okay, we have a meeting and we'll see what to do. And we met that Saturday and I left. Then another time we were invited to speak in a church. And Mary came along with us. And I think that's where we began our public speaking campaign.
Yeah. Yeah. Dominic came off the plane like this. I swear to God. He was just poised and ready. It was the most amazing thing. I still to this day don't know how that's remotely possible. The first real distinct memory, Dominic was just working with me. I was working with about, 150 guys? So the first initial meeting to me is blurry, but one meeting that really stands out in my mind, I was taking all of the guys to a basketball game, all 150. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I remember.
And it was in, I had a connection with the Atlanta Hawks, so I had my little inn, and so I took them to this basketball game, and Dominic sat next to me, and we just started talking, and he knew everything about basketball. I mean, he knew the rules, he knew the players, he knew everything, and I was just so impressed with his, he just knew everything for some reason. And it was impressive to me. And so that's what I really remember about him. And then also seeing him speak for that first time. And when he tells a story, it's not like, oh, poor me, poor me. It's this is how it happened, and this is why it happened, and this is why I hope it doesn't ever happen to anybody else. And it was just a really beautiful, straightforward presentation that really moved me and moves everybody who hears him. But he's right after that first talk in the church. I was like, we got to put him on the road. And so we put him on the road.
And at the same time, so Valentino started speaking on behalf of the Lost Boys in Atlanta, and at the same time, you were helping with Val getting a job because of some of the PR campaigns you had done in the local news. And what was that? There were many different jobs before the one in the furniture emporium. But do you want to talk about sort of how people came? They would hear about all the guys who had been resettled, and then offered different, different work. You want to talk about sort of?
Yeah, we got this amazing core group of volunteers who heard the story and they were just committed and just bent over backward for the guys. And we did an amazing PR campaign. We were always in the local paper. We did. We even had a lot of national publicity. We did Oprah Winfrey Show. We did People Magazine. We did World News Tonight, CNN. I mean, it was just it was a juggernaut. And Lost Boys were like rock stars in Atlanta. I mean, they couldn't walk down the street. People would pull over in their cars. Are you a Lost Boy? Are you a Lost Boy? and we just kind of raised it as much as we could. So we got a lot of people coming in offering jobs. And Valentino got this amazing job at this really upscale furniture. Shop. You want to talk about your job?
Yeah, it was an interior design showroom.
Yeah.
I quickly learned how to advise people on what fabrics to use. I work at a store called Grizzle and Man, and there was a fabric showrooms and people who want good fabrics for sofas for their. Tan and everything, comes there. And there I was learning. In 3 weeks, I became a friend to my bosses and I was raised and quickly became a supervisor of that showroom. But yeah, it was an interesting job. Unlike many of my friends, that job, actually now we have more than 12 people working in that store. And I really like that. I began it and they're still employing Sudanese.
Oh, really?
Yeah, in that store. But I was one of the lucky ones to get that job because many people were working in places like Target, loading, okay. and many other meat storage, and they weren't getting paid enough, or you know the money that they could use to pay their rent. But yeah, that was the beginning.
What was it like, Valentino, in those first couple times and over that first year, telling your story to groups, to churches, to schools, to community groups? You told it so many times. What were you sort of? What was the reaction, and what effect did it have on you?
Like Mary said already, that Lost Boys like rock star. We're like rock stars in Atlanta. I did most of those. Appearance on CNN and in newspapers, and I realized that the story was gaining more publicity and that I needed to take the story to a certain level where it would not only be focused on particular group, the Lost Boys, but on a larger group, the nations, the people that were affected by that conflict. The Lost Boys are micro percentage of the population of Sudanese that were subject to many atrocities in Sudan. And through my speaking event, you know, I realized that I have to take this challenge, that this story has to be told and I have to do it. And actually, there were a few writers who were interested in working with me. And one day I went to Mary and I said, "Look, Mary, I think I need to have my story documented in a written form. Would you help me?" And Mary, like she always play, was like, "Oh, I'll find someone. Just relax, we'll do it." And then, you know, that's how she went out to reach to Dave, and Lisa would call me and say, "Valentino, I found the right writer. Let's work with you." And so when I used to tell my story, people were interested in the story. It was something that many of my audience have never heard. And people would always imagine, "What happened to you? How did you survive?" And I would say, "It's not how I survived that I want to share with you. It's how we can stop this conflict, because there are more people, there are many people who are going through this." And I remember speaking to a group of high school students one day in Atlanta. I was a school known as Pace Academy. And the kids seemed to not even know where Sudan was. And I said, "This could not be true. Because if you don't know Sudan, then I'm not doing my right thing. I'm not educating people." It was all about educating people and making them understand the story and telling the story well. You know, that is what I discovered through my speaking event. And I realized that people need to know more about my story than just me coming and standing for 5 minutes or 30 minutes or 40 minutes and then go away.
Now, people ask a lot, Mary. People say, when I talk about how I got a letter in the mail in the fall of 2002, and the first question everybody asks is, "Why you?" Meaning, why me? And it's a good question.
We never talked about that.
I don't think I was an intuitive choice necessarily.
You don't know the story at all.
Yeah, tell
us the
story.
Let me tell you the story.
I've never asked you this. I was always afraid to ask because I assumed I was like choice number 8, so I didn't really know. Yeah, after all the other writers said no, that's when we went down the list.
Dave was actually choice number 1. I was listening to Valentino, and I agree that, you know, this story needs to be taken in a broader context. You know, I'm going to do my own marketing, and I'm going to help people do my marketing. And so I did a children's book, and then I was conceptualizing a children's book, and I was minding my own business. I was on my way to Maine to visit a sister. I was in a bookstore, and I saw this book with the most bizarre title. Cocky, just bizarre, "A Heartbreaking Work of Staggering Genius" by Dave Eggers. I said, okay. So, of course, I read the first little copyright page, and I laughed till I peed myself, and it was the book for me. Not thinking anything, because I'm just a reader, looking for a good book. And as I was on the plane, I was reading this book. This was a book by a lost boy. That's what I thought as I read this book. This is Dave's life. He's a a young man, and he has a small brother, and he loses his parents within weeks of each other, and he's on his own with his brother. I mean, he's got the support of siblings, but he's primarily raising this child, and they're traveling around, and they're trying to make a life for themselves, and I immediately made this connection to Lost Boys. And so when I got back to Atlanta, I just wrote a letter to his publisher saying, hey, you seem like a lost boy. Do you know the story? And would you mind, you know, maybe, I don't know exactly what the letter said. I think I said, would you be interested in writing an article about them, you know, just to help me kind of get the word out about this story? And then, like, almost immediately I got a response like, yeah, I think I would. And I'm going to, would like to come out and meet them, and I'd like to write a book. And so.
Oh, it wasn't that quick, though.
Was it? It seemed like overnight, but...
Well, we went... So that came in November, I think. Mm-hmm. And then in January, I came out for the party.
No, I meant your response back to me.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah. We started talking about it, and I didn't know what would come of it exactly. But I think it was that first meeting in January. Then things started when we all spent that weekend together.
Oh, okay, got it.
When we started really thinking seriously about it. But tell us about that weekend. And this was a party to celebrate...
The birthday.
You know, the birthday that all of the, yeah. all, everyone celebrated. Tell us how this happened, the January 1st birthday.
Yeah.
Mary become like a mother to everybody. And we have this weird birthday where everybody have January the 1st. And I think many immigrants who comes from societies where birthdays are not mandated, you know, usually takes January the 1st as their birthday when they come to the U.S., and so Mary organized this birthday party I think it was in Omni Hotel in Atlanta. And all of us and many of our friends from the neighboring states of Tennessee, Florida, North Carolina, you know, turned up that weekend. It was on January 11, 2002, if I have good memory.
2003.
2002. It was 2002, not 2003.
No way! Yeah. It was definitely 2003.
I remember, yeah. It was 2002.
Oh. It couldn't have been.
2003 is when we went to Sudan. We met. Already.
We went December of 2003.
Okay.
So, it was, yeah. We'll figure it out later. But it was
excellent.
Somewhere around there.
Yeah. But, yeah, after that, you know, then many people came and there was a party. There were many guys and fewer or even no girls dancing.
There was a lot of grumbling about that.
Great
party, not enough ladies.
On the same weekend, the Atlanta Hawks were playing I think it was with the Orlando Magic.
The team?
Yeah, they were playing that weekend. And I used to get family seats from Mary always. So putting me right in front of the game. And then that weekend is when Dave also was in town.
Manute Ball.
Manute Ball was in town. Manute Ball played for this city, right?
Yeah.
Sometime, I remember.
He sat right there, courtside.
Yeah, he sat right there on the courtside, and these players were coming to greet him. I thought I was tall, and they make me like this. And then during the game, too, there was my first encounter with the cheerleaders. So during break time, you know, they came up dancing, and I was like, what is this? I needed them to dance more than the game itself. Well, it was a good weekend. That's how we met, and Dave was writing stories, and Mary, of course, I think was there, was used to all of this reaction. And that's how that happened. The weekend was meant to be for the birthday party, and it was a collective birthday party. And at the same time, the volunteers would come to that party and meet with new guys or anybody who just want to mingle with the Sudanese and know them would come there. Some people who have money to give to the program and support our tutoring program also were invited. So the activities we used to do, you know, like if it is a birthday, it's not only meant to celebrate the birth of 150 people. Mm-hmm. It's meant to raise funds, to create awareness, and also to help people interact with the community.
Like Thanksgiving.
like Thanksgiving, we would have Jane Fonda, the main speaker. it was fun.
Mary, what was it like to try to bring in so many? Because, you know, I know that you were trying to hook up almost every guy that had been resettled in the Atlanta area with a volunteer or a family or somebody, a mentor who could help guide them through, you know, navigate through all kinds of, you know, issues that would come up. Mm-hmm. And I know, I remember talking to you about sort of you were like just fervent about trying to hook up everybody with somebody because everybody really needed that friend. And who, you know, how did you find those volunteers and what was it like to sort of see who they were and also know how long it actually took them to sort of, it wasn't a 3-month process or a 6-month process to get acclimated, but.
It was actually, working with the Lost Boys is one of the hardest jobs I've ever had because I did take it so seriously and I worked beyond a 40-hour work week. I worked until, you know, I couldn't work anymore. And because of all the publicity that we did and because they had that rock star status, it was fairly easy getting those volunteers in there. What was hard is getting them to stick sometimes, really trying to find who's going to be in there for the long haul. I had volunteers that actually incorporated the young man into their home and sent them to college and just became a part of the family, like Ernest. And then I had... Dominic got some amazing volunteers. He got a young family with twins who kind of took care of him. Then there were people who thought it was kind of cute and wonderful to do and then kind of fell off, and then the young man didn't have anybody. But so it was difficult. It was easy to get them in there, but sometimes it was hard to make them stick. Is that the question?
Yeah. Okay. No, that's good.
Okay.
And Valentino, even in those first few weeks when we were all talking about this, I sort of made a promise that we would finish a book within a year. You probably remember this and how ridiculous of a promise that was to make, and it's just one of the silly things I say.
I didn't know that you told me years later that you almost gave up on it, but you didn't say anything.
Oh, yeah. 6 months. At least 6 times I gave up on it. Like, really, like, cowering and curled up in a corner, like, you know, sucking my thumb. Like, really, just, I couldn't, you know, mainly because as the months went by and I couldn't figure out the best way to tell the story, structure the story, I felt like every passing month and year, I was wasting more of Valentino's time, and I was breaking a promise. And the promise was to not just tell the story, but to tell it well, and so that we would be able to reach a lot of people, and not just the NGO, you know, crowd that was already maybe interested in the story. It was, I didn't tell you about all those struggles necessarily, and Valentino knows of a few of them, but...
Was that after we became rebel in South Sudan?
Yeah, that was in 2003, Valentino and I went back. Now, Mary helped us arrange a trip about a year after we met in December of 2003. We can argue about that later. We went back, and Mary arranged a trip that we went to Nairobi, and then we had to become members of the SPLA, the Sudan People's Liberation Army movement. We have official ID cards to this day that declare us members of the organization so that we could go into South Sudan and back to Valentino's hometown. Can you talk about that trip and sort of, I remember when we were just, we had made a few stops in southern Sudan on the way, and then when we were flying low over, and they said, you know, that Mario Bai, there's a, used to be a more often used landing strip that bisected the town. When we were coming over that and the pilot said we were coming close to Mario Bai, I asked you if you recognized the landscape, if this looked like home to you. And what did you say? And what were those first impressions when you got off the plane?
It was hard to believe that that was the Mario Bai I left in 1987 because the... So many things have changed. There were fewer people in town, fewer houses. Many of the homes had been burned and by Moralin. Moralin are the same group that we know as Janjaweed today, so that people can understand it. They're not different. It's just the name that had changed, but the groups is the same, and their tactics have been the same in the south. They had burned homes, they had displaced thousands of people from the area. And when I went back, you know, trying to remember the picture of what Moribai used to be before I left, and then landing, you know, I couldn't recognize the place. We even landed at the hair strips, and my family was there, and I hardly could recognize my parents. They had dried up a little bit, and Dad didn't look the same, Mom didn't look the same, and I was like, wow, 16 years, and my family had been, you know, had stayed in Moralbai, experiencing, you know, successive Moralin assault and seeing many of their friends and neighbors killed, and even missing their son. So I saw a different Moralbai that was destroyed, and people even had almost lost hopes. I remember telling Dave that I no longer feel like I had suffered a lot, that I feel that the people who remain in Sudan, who never went to a refugee camp or to a foreign country, had suffered a lot. And that changed my views of the conflict of Sudan and how I look at myself into it. From that day, I became a person who wanted to help my people regain hopes, than being the person who always complained that I had lost so much, I grew up from a foreign country. So that's what it was. And then I looked at young people. They were either in the army or they were very young children. And I looked at women. They had lost a husband or a son. Or there are girls who were married at a very young age. And everything had changed in the area. Just what the pictures we see in Darfur today are the same pictures that existed in southern Sudan from 1983 to 2005, when the Southern Sudanese Rebel Group and the Sudanese government signed a peace agreement. So that was the Moralbai I went back to. And you could remember that I changed at that moment from someone who used to smile a lot to someone who would see and meet everybody and feel the burden. To the worst, everyone in town was running to me, calling my name, hugging me, crying, saying all sorts of things. And they would just be there, take a picture or just look at me.
I remember that, yeah, you... I had never seen you so burdened during that trip and afterward. And it was an interesting trip in other ways, in that we were there one night. I forget how we heard about it, but there was a commotion near one of the there was an NGO working there, and there was one TV for, I don't know, dozens of miles or 100 miles, and they had it set up outside by the airstrip, and we went to it and saw that everyone was watching CNN because they had just captured Saddam Hussein, and we had saw that. Remember this, and I remember there was actually some hope then from some of the guys that were assembled watching it that this was actually a good thing for Sudan, and it might mean that the U.S. might take push more for replace the regime in Khartoum. Anyway, I wanted to go back and talk about we should jump forward to your most recent trip to Moralbai. We went there over the summer,
yeah,
and sort of with an idea toward why don't you talk about the foundation that you formed and the goals of the foundation, and then also sort of what it was like this time in the summer to go back and start enacting your plans, and then this most recent trip. Sorry, that's like 8 things in a row.
Then after everything, after the book was out in 2006, it happened that many people who picked up the book and read it liked it, and they recommended it to more people. and we had sold some copies, then I thought that to help in Sudan, we should have a project connected with the book, and the proceed from the book will fund part of that project. And we started the Valentino Achardeng Foundation. Dave actually helped set it up. And portions of the proceeds from the book go to that foundation. And we're building a second school, a community multi-purpose center, and a library in Marial Bay. That is the beginning, but we'll move to other areas. The reason we thought about building secondary school is that many NGOs and the local governments in Sudan are emphasizing, you know, they are building primary schools, but there are kids already finishing from elementary school and want to go to high school, and where would they go? So then we changed from our focus on primary education to the secondary school education. And then I looked at the women in Marial Bay, and they were so burdened. Apart from living in a male-dominated society where they work from 6 to 6 p.m. and the other one taking care of children, you know, they even don't have a chance to think about running their own businesses. They are widows whose husbands are not there, but they're not running businesses. And we also thought that, you know, building a community center where they would be trained on micro enterprise and also gender issues, because the women in Sudan need to be educated on gender issues. They need to know where their right is and where their rights are not. You know, that community center will focus on that. It will also train youth. And we'll emphasize on recreational activities. Young girls need to be sent to school, but they need to be educated from the very early age. So the community center will do that. And then our library will serve both the schools and the community, because many students could not afford to buy books. When we went to Marial Bay, teachers had to share textbooks, and they take note and write on the board. Many of the students have never touched a textbook, and if we have one library that will be stocked with textbook, you know, the student could go to the library, read, and leave it for another student to read later. So the library will serve that purpose. I began that work. The construction has already started. We bought a truck that would be transporting cement and other construction material from Kampala, Uganda, to South Sudan. So that is what my recent trip was about, is to work.
Well, I should... Valentino's being... Can you still hear me?
Yep.
No, it's not working. It is? All right. He's being humble here because it... The project that he's undertaken, Valentino just got back 2 days ago from Uganda, and where he was organizing this incredibly huge mission by himself. In that was bringing, he had to buy two trucks, load them with cement, 40 tons of cement in Uganda, drive it 5 days north to Marial Bay, and has to get all these construction materials back to Marial Bay before the rainy season begins and most of the roads are washed out. So it's an incredibly huge undertaking. And when we were together over the summer there, it was an amazing thing to see how much the community was behind your plans and sort of how everybody rallied together. And when we were there, they almost immediately granted Valentino a big tract of land right outside of town, and was everybody was ready to get behind your whole the whole educational complex that you had planned. And did you expect everyone to be so sort of single-minded about building this? And tell us what's next.
Yeah, I expected them to be single-minded because, for one thing, they didn't have a secondary school. They do not have a community center. They do not have a library. And these are things that they wanted, and those are the things that we are bringing to them. That is why they gave us land. That's why any time I go there, the government officials are behind us. So we have 100% support from the local Sudanese government as well as the local chiefs and the local elders. I remember when we went there and they gave us land, they were dancing. I was even dancing with women myself. They thought I had forgotten. They thought I had forgotten how to dance. And they were impressed. So I have the local support. What I do not have is how to be able to finish this project. And I believe and I pray that it will succeed.
I hope that it's clear that every copy of the book sold in hardcover and paperback, everybody that reads it is a participant, because all of the money that isn't the publisher's goes to the foundation. And so everybody is a direct participant in Valentino's project. But there's also some tension right now in southern Sudan. I wonder if you could talk about what's going on along the border. You know, the U.S. Helped broker this peace, that after 20-something years of war between the North and the South, there was peace in 2005. But in the last few years, it's been said that the U.S. government and the international community has been focused elsewhere, and in Iraq and Afghanistan and Darfur. And meanwhile, there's great tension happening along the border between North and South. And you saw some of this. Can you talk about some of the fighting along the border?
Yeah, sometime I am caught in a dilemma, you know, when I speak about my country. Because when I talk about South Sudan, where there is relative peace right now, there's also Darfur, where many atrocities are still being committed, and I feel like I'm leaving out part of the issue. The conflict that has been taking place in Darfur has not ended, and the same military that is used to kill the civilian in Darfur, you know, has also been reactivated on the southern part, especially at the border. And a few weeks ago, I witnessed one of the conflict where the Murhalin, the Janjaweed, tried to come to the south and attack villages, and they fought with the SPLA soldiers. I actually went to the war battle and saw many corpses there. So there are still problems at the border, because the peace agreement allows South Sudan to vote for self autonomy in 2011, and the Sudanese National Congress Party, you know, does not like that, and they are trying to abrogate that peace agreement by reactivating former military groups to go back to the south and cause more chaos. Meanwhile, the conflict in Darfur is also taking place.
Are you hopeful? And are the people in Mario Bay and Awil and the other towns that you were in, is there still hope because you're building a school and the schools in the south are overflowing? And when we were there over the summer, there was a great deal of optimism and just a lot of projects being undertaken. And since then, there's been more insecurity along the border. And I wonder what the mood is when you were there just this past time, and also are you still hopeful about the future?
I'm very hopeful about the future. In Sudan, there's what they call peace through development. And what they're doing is everyone who is involved in any construction or infrastructure is doing that work. We believe that, you know, South and North will not go back to war. Was the president of South Sudan, Salva Kiir, stated it clearly and publicly that he's not taking people back to war. And if President Bashir started that, it will be a different issue. The problem in Sudan right now is the Darfur conflict. When it is ended, people will look for different means of resolving the issues. In moral buy and in will, people are, you know, normal. They're not running. The fighting only takes place at the border, and it is terminal. It's not a continuous fighting. They just hit and run. It's a sabotage. It's a plan to, you know, interrupt the implementation of the peace agreement. But it's not that worrying. That's why I am sending trucks there. They're worth a lot of money. We would not do that. If there is war in Sudan and I can't do anything, I would work in Kenya and help the people in Kenya. That's my goal. I will help wherever I can. But right now, there's no problem in Sudan. The peace agreement is still in place.
Before I forget, we should also say that when you went to Sudan this time, you went to Kenya. Went to Nairobi first.
Yeah.
And you want to tell us about when you got there? And
yeah, it's funny. I told you how I came here and my flight was on September 11. I went back to Kenya last December. And it happened that I landed in Kenya and then the next day, Kenyan political turmoil started. And I was like, no way. This cannot happen. So I was stranded in Kenya too. When you heard a lot about the political crisis in Kenya, I was there. And I made sure I have my U.S. passport with me always so that they don't confuse me in that.
I don't know if we've said that Valentino became a U.S. citizen. How long ago? A year or so ago?
Yeah, actually, my passport was issued through the state of Pennsylvania from Philadelphia. Yeah, it was a quick thing. I had only 3 days to leave, and I did not have a passport. So Greg, one of our staff members, tried to figure out away and he found someone here in Philadelphia to do it for us. So I got my passport in May last year.
But the guy that you applied for the passport, the passport officer, said, "Are you the same Valentino Deng
yes,
from this book?"
Yes, he read the book, actually, yeah.
So that's where it helped with the expediting of that passport.
Yeah. He read the book and he actually emailed me in Sudan a couple of weeks ago. We're staying in touch. He read the book, and after the passport thing, then he called back and said, "Are you the same Valentino from the book?" And I said, "Yes." And he's like, "I can't believe this." I said, "All right." Then he said, "You're getting your passport tomorrow."
We should go to you guys if you have a few questions for about 10 minutes. And then, right here and... there'll be microphones, I guess, coming to everybody.
Go on.
Just speak into it.
Oh. What does China have to do with this conflict? You hear different things, and it's not really clear. And do they play a significant role in this drama?
You want that one?
China buys the Sudanese oil. And I think if you buy someone's stock in the market, you're supporting that business. So when China buys the Sudanese oil, the Sudanese government use that oil money to buy weapon. That is what I know about the relationship between the Chinese government and the Sudanese government. And they have been long-term allies. China also sells arms to the Sudanese army. I think that is the relationship. Otherwise, I do not know so much about that.
They also protect Sudanese interests in the Security Council. So whenever the UN wants to take a certain action against the government of Sudan for atrocities in Darfur or elsewhere, they tend to protect them and vote against such resolutions. And so it's been really hard for years now to get, you know, binding and tough resolutions to stick against the Sudanese, because they're protected in all ways by the Chinese government. And so, as many of you know, right now there's a campaign to sort of link this, the Chinese and Sudanese connection. Steven Spielberg, who was supposed to be the artistic director of the Beijing Olympics, dropped out over their inability or unwillingness to take a stronger stance against Sudan. And, right now the torch that's going to make its way to Beijing is passing through San Francisco on April 9th, and there's going to be a giant protest to sort of, people have labeled it the Genocide Olympics, and if they don't take, because they're the ones that really have a lot of muscle when it comes to influencing Sudan. And so if they took just a little bit more, if they did just a little bit more, a lot would happen. And so that's the pressure point right now, is China. Yes.
A man in the book who is a heroic figure in leading you and the other young boys out of Mario Bay. I'm not sure the pronunciation. Dut.
Dut.
What happened to Dut?
That Dut is not alive. He trained, went back to the SPLA, and was killed in 1999 in the battle. He became some kind of a general or a commander. Yeah, there are many men of his kind who didn't make it. They went back straight to fight.
There were a lot of elders that led the young boys and girls to Ethiopia that are often forgotten in the whole story. And we met a lot of them when we were at Kakuma in 2003. We had a big meeting with dozens of the elders who were also asking, is there a chance we could be resettled in the U.S. and hoping that we might be able to help? Remember that meeting? That was hard.
Yes, yeah. They became our head caretakers. And then when the process came in 1999, they weren't allowed to come with us. And many of them are still in the refugee camp. And they want to be given durable solution, and that is resettlement into the Western world or anywhere. But they weren't able to find that, and at some point they feel like they stayed with us, they helped us, and then after all they were abandoned. So we found a few of them who were complaining about that.
I wondered when I read the book why it took so long for them to select you to come to the United States, because it was so clear throughout that you were extraordinary. And then my second question is, I see you have a wedding ring on. Are you married?
So this ring is causing trouble. I am not married officially, but they're trying to arrange something traditionally. That's why there's a ring here in Sudan. At the American level, you wouldn't say you're married until you have a wedding. At the Sudanese level, where you pay a dowry, you know, there's always a process, and I'm trying to combine the two. You know, letting the traditional one be done first, and then I'll come up with the modern wedding thing.
But you should say that this is a young woman that you met, and it's that you have been known for a long time.
This is somebody I've known for a long time. And I hardly don't talk about that, except in what is the word when we talk about the royal girls of Pinyuru.
You can't get away with it without with the ring. That's always that's a telltale thing. I can't.
Okay. And then, your first question was about why it took them long to get us here. This was arranged. Our process of coming to the U.S. was arranged by the United Nations and the U.S. government. The U.S. government accepted to bring the Sudanese youth into the U.S. That process was even supposed to begin in 1997, as I was told. I was the youth leader in the camp, and I used to get news of what was going to happen. But it took some time until 1999 and 2000. And I don't know why it took so long. And also we had changed refugee camps from Ethiopia to Kenya and even to Uganda. So I think usually the UN usually wait to know whether or not a refugee that needs to be resettled has a well-founded fear of persecution. In our case, that fear should have been proven maybe 10 years before we were brought here. But then at that point, I didn't even know anything, you know, and I don't know why it took so much time.
Maybe two more questions? Yeah.
I was very touched by your relationship with the Japanese gentleman who worked with you and his death and your perception in writing about his family. Have you stayed in touch with his family and continue a relationship? Because it seemed to me you had something very special going with that gentleman.
I have managed to stay in touch with the director of our of that Japanese organization that I work for, and but the family, you know, they didn't speak English at all. They only came to the camp when their son was dead, and we were even being translated and were crying. It was so emotional at that time I met them, and it was hard to follow up with them. But every time I write to the director of the project, I always ask him to say hi to the family. And it's my dream that one day I'll go to Tokyo and try to meet them.
I
will do that.
And the red right here?
Yeah, I have to say thank you so much to Mary for all the work that you did and to Valentino for rising above your own personal experience to bring to us the terrible suffering of the people in Sudan, and to Dave for being such a clear window and giving access to Valentino's beautiful voice. I just really want to thank you for what you've given us. And I also wanted to just say to the audience that in Philadelphia, we have your baby sister organization here. We have the Darfur Alert Coalition, and we're working on the issue of Darfur, and we work very closely with the Sudanese community. And I would encourage everybody to get our literature out on the table and to work with us. We're working on a similar project for a refugee camp in outside of Al-Fashir in Darfur, Sudan, to build a center. So if you're interested in working with us, we're delighted. And Valentino, you're a neighbor, so we have to stay in touch. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
I don't know what the time is like. It's 8:30. I thought, should we wrap up? Or okay, one more here in the orange, sorry.
First of all, thank you so much for being here and for sharing you, all of you, with us. I want to just go to a different step in terms of what we can do. The city of Philadelphia has already divested its funds from Sudan. I know now in the State House in Harrisburg, either the House or the Senate has passed something to divest, but it's stuck, I think, in the House at the moment. So one question is, do you think that this kind of action really has an effect on the Sudanese government? And secondly, my second question is, with your foundation, you said you need books, you're putting together a new library. What can we, like I'm a lawyer and people are come from other, can we donate books to you? Do you need that kind of donation? I'm not sure, so I thought I would ask.
I'll say really quickly that books are probably the harder thing to transport. A lot of books from here to Mario Bay is prohibitively expensive, or at least right now. So the books will be coming from closer areas. Do you know where that you're going to get them from?
I'll buy books from Kenya and Uganda. That is closer, and then ship them across the border. But to get the books from the U.S. to Kenya, if you buy one book, by the time it gets to Kenya, you will have bought 5 or 6 books. That's a lot, but if you can, there's a way you could buy one book in Kenya and get it to Sudan as one book without paying 5 books to get one book to Sudan. Yeah, that is how we could do. But also to get the books into Mariel Bay, we need to build a library before we get the books there and furnish it. That is the priority, is to build the library, finish it. And just like I do, I go to Sudan, take pictures of what I'm doing, and then come back and show the people, this is what I am doing. Yeah. So.
Valentino's website is valentinoashakdeng.com.org, in case you want to see pictures of Valentino. That was last trip, which will be, we'll up.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.